Hello, and welcome to this magical talk in the magical world of Toronto, Canada. It's not really that magical. We have construction, though. And this is the talk on the occult on Apple GPU. I'm Alyssa Rosenzweig, your resident witch, and we'll be going on a magical adventure. Ooh. For some introduction, let's meet the wizards we'll see on the way. There are four of them, not just one when you follow the yellow brick road. That would be Dougal Johnson, who reverse engineered most of the instructions that we'll be talking about today. Hector Martin, who's been spearheading the whole Linux on M1 project. Sven Peter, who is our resident kernel hacker, and myself. As is tradition for any fruit-related device, there is the disclaimer that this was designed by Asahi in Canada and was assembled by cheap labor in, wait, also Canada. That was me. I don't get paid for this. Fine. To start off, I would like to talk about the DCP. This is a, today we'll be talking about the graphics stack on the Apple M1. And like any ARM system, there is the display processor, which is responsible for HDMI, and the GPU, which is responsible for the 3D rendering. And these are two unrelated blocks of proprietary Apple hardware. We'll be talking about both today. So first, I would like to talk about the DCP, which is responsible for the display side. The DCP is the acronym. Based on our best guess, based on the behavior of it, it stands for Diabolical Cluster Puck. Wait, that can't be right. This is the display coprocessor. It manages the display controller. It is not the display controller. That's a key distinction. It is a coprocessor that has its own coprocessor. It's coprocessors all the way down. There are 7 megabytes of firmware on this thing. Linux or macOS does not talk to the display controller itself. Those registers are just not even in the device tree. There's this massive pile of firmware with its own pile of firmware that does all of the display controller interaction. And we just have a API to deal with in the kernel space. Yeah, I don't know either. Like, what is happening here? The DCP runs the RTKit operating system. This is the real-time kit. It is Apple's secret real-time operating system that is running on every piece of firmware, or not every, with the exception of the Secure Enclave, which has its own Secure Enclave operating system. It's running on essentially all of the coprocessors on Apple devices. It's also running on things like the AirPods. It's a fairly large operating system, not by Linux or macOS standards, but by the sorts of things you'd run on a firmware with real-time constraints. I mean, it's a whole system. And for our purposes, we're not interested in RTKit per se. We're just interested in interfacing with it. And all of the RTKit processors have a standard interface over shared memory, because this is a system on chip, which means we have that shared memory, which is very high performance. And there is a physical mailbox, which is symmetric between the application processor running Linux and the coprocessor running RTKit. And this just lets them send about 64 bits of data per message, which means you're not actually sending commands for the DCP in this case over the mailbox. You're just sending a command with a essentially a pointer to shared memory to look up the actual command, which could be several kilobytes in some cases. Again, why we don't, I'm here to explain what Apple has done in their design. I am not here to explain why anybody thought these were good design choices. At any rate, the DCP is worse than just any old RTKit firmware. The other RTKit firmwares, they are at least on a very well-defined interface. The system management controller, for example, it has a very simple interface based on key values and some interrupts and that sorts of things. It makes sense. The kernel driver for it makes, okay, it doesn't make sense, but by Apple standards, it makes sense. The DCP, on the other hand, the firmware is a massive pile of object-oriented C++ code, not C code, and the whole thing is just based on arbitrary remote procedure calls. There's not a defined ABI between the application processor and the DCP. You're just making calls across one processor to the next processor, it's worse because the calls that you make, you might need to make other calls to respond to them, and the DCP might need to make more calls to respond back and forth. And so in effect, you have a call stack that crosses across multiple coprocessors, all on a completely unstable ABI. So every single time macOS updates and there's a kernel update with a firmware update, the entire ABI changes. All of the enumeration of calls is completely different, which means we can't even just pin one version of the firmware because there will be changes in the future. We're just stuck trying to deal with all of these different pieces of slightly different firmware at the same time and being denied access to hardware. And I can't even complain because apparently this is the status quo for macOS now, because macOS is doing the same exact interface we are. The only benefit that macOS gets that we don't is that they can pin a specific version of firmware for every kernel because they're able to distribute a single kernel image bundled with the firmware. We don't have that luxury since we need to be able to support different distribution kernels with a given piece of macOS firmware on the DCP. And so you might ask, where did this massive pile of 7 megabytes of C++ firmware come from? While we haven't done too much forensics on it, the most likely scenario would seem to be that they just took their old iPhone display driver, split it in half like it's a sandwich, and then stuck one half on the application processor and stuck the other half on the DCP and called that a design. Why this is desirable? Again, my magic only goes so far. How does this look in Linux? Well, it's very goofy. We're still going to expose a basic DRM driver the same way any other display controller would work. It's still a KMS driver. We're still supporting the full Atomic API, but it's really goofy looking. Usually, the display drivers are taking in the changes in the graphic state from DRM and then setting registers to actualize it on the hardware. And then there's a ton of work to pipe the interrupts through for vBlank and so forth, hot plug. And it's, you know, hardware drivers. We don't get that luxury. We're just doing remote procedure calls all the way down. And by the way, we're writing it in C code, not C++, despite the fact that we're interacting with a C++ API that has classes and objects is just part of the definition of the API, which is, you know, the driver is haunted by the ghosts of IO Surface and IO Kit and all of these Appleisms, which really belong in the space of macOS and which we really would like to keep in the space of macOS, except for the fact that, well, we don't have that choice. Oh, well. So again, what is happening here? I mean, taking a step back, taking some of the emotion out of it for a little bit. Yes, it's goofy looking. Yes, I'm a little scared of the maintenance burden, but it's actually not very much code relative to other display drivers. And I mean, it works. I'm giving this talk from Linux on my M1 device right now. That's half true. The camera is on my phone, but the slides are all being presented from GNOME at 4K60 on my M1 Mini, and the audio is going over USB headphones. And I mean, it's entirely possible that I'm just speaking to myself because the whole setup has collapsed. But if you are hearing this, the drivers work. I hope you're hearing this. So that's all I want to say about the diabolical cluster puck for now. I mean, the display coprocessor for now. And with that, I'd like to turn our attention to the other half of the Apple graphic stack on the M1, and that is the AGX. This is most likely the Apple graphics or Apple graphic accelerator. The fact that it's called AGX does not bode well for those of you who are still haunted by PowerVR, which has SGX and RGX. Actually, I'll do you one worse. In the Apple device tree, the node for the AGX GPU is labeled SGX. I don't even want to think about the implications of how that came about. At any rate, the AGX is the Apple GPU. It is like its PowerVR predecessor, a Tyler. The instruction set is very modern, very forward-thinking. it's purely scalar, not this half scalar, half vector dance that a lot of, for example, the modern Mali GPUs do and the AMD GPUs do. This is just scalar all the way down. There's no there's no silliness around SIMD widths like the Intel instruction set. All in all, it's actually a really lovely instruction set to program for. And it was a lot of fun bringing up a compiler for it. Even the scheduling model, from what we can tell, seems very sane, since it's the details of the internal pipeline don't get exposed to the compiler. So if you just write code like you would write assembly by hand, that will be functionally accurate in every case we're aware of. The only scheduling-like work that is functionally required is just dependency weights for and scoreboarding for textures and memory loads. That said, it does appear that the hardware is dual issue or maybe multi-issue or something along those lines. So there is a performance benefit to reordering instructions in a to group them in certain ways. And so you will see the Apple compiler reordering a little bit. For the most part, I'm not worried about scheduling for this hardware in the same way I would be for just about every other GPU out there. So nice instruction set, evil display coprocessor, I guess that averages out to a just average level of insanity in your graphics stack, because everybody has something insane in their graphics stack. Don't even get me started on the Rockchip one. The other key point that I'd like to emphasize about the Apple GPU is that Apple has their own graphics rendering API, Metal. There is no support for Vulkan except partial support via a third-party Molten Vulkan. There is very limited support for OpenGL and OpenGL-ES. I have not seen a conformance submission for either in years from Apple, and it's even when things are functional there, it's not clear that it would be using the hardware in an optimal way, simply because it's not the priority. And the bottom line is that this is a part made for Metal. It has all the features needed to efficiently implement Metal. It does not have all the features necessary to implement OpenGL. And we'll see the implication of that in a second, because we do support AGX and Mesa now. The initial code for this landed in April of 2021. It's seen active entry development since then, and it's a totally standard OpenGL driver in Mesa using the Gallium 3D infrastructure for the driver. Totally normal stuff. It's just a command stream. There's really, I was going to present about it, but there's really nothing special here. It's a Gallium driver. What am I supposed to say? And there's a NUR compiler, which, again, totally standard. NUR is a joy to work with. Huge kudos to Jason and friends for making a immediate representation that's totally lovely. And it compiles to the hardware, which, again, the instruction set is lovely. So we're all good. We have our OpenGL driver, right? Well, we're still reverse engineering this thing, and Metal lacks key OpenGL features, which means that when we hit one of these features, we have just a few options. We could be, one, non-conformant, not an option. So we'll call that option zero. So zero, non-conformant. One, we could just emulate it in some highly inefficient way in some cases, or just a mildly inefficient way. And we have to do this in a couple cases. We could, two, try to reverse engineer what little OpenGL support is present in macOS. But this is non-trivial, since the GL environment there is frankly harder to work with than the one on Android. And if any of you have had to reverse engineer on Android before, that should paint a picture. Or three, four, but three if we're counting from zero, just try to guess our way through. And that does work, right? I was able to guess the magic numbers. Ooh, magic! For drawing quads, for example, that was fine. But it's not a fun time, because, again, part made for Metal. We're not supporting Metal on Linux. We're supporting GL and eventually Vulkan. There's a huge impedance mismatch there. The One thing that we have to our benefit is that metal in many ways is close to Vulcan in its capabilities, which means most of the problems we're facing have already been faced by the zinc driver. And in other cases, a lot of the stuff removed in hardware from AGX was already removed from the AMD hardware, which means you have Radeon SI and ACO as your cheat sheet on how to handle those. So it's frustrating, a little annoying, but not anywhere near the league of the DCP. So I best should not complain, because the AGX all in all is a nice GPU. So it's natural that we have some fun with AGX. Let's talk about divergence. There are lots of ways to handle divergence in hardware. Divergence in graphics hardware. The non-way is to just do no warping whatsoever, just like a CPU, and then there's no problem. However, modern GPU designs want to execute multiple threads at the same time. At minimum, have 4 threads together, usually 8, 16, maybe even up to 64 in the case of AMD. And the problem with doing this is that if one thread tries to branch in one direction and the other thread branches another direction, for example, if you have an if statement, then which one do you execute? Well, you have to execute both and turn off some threads at some point, turn off the other half at the other point, and try to reconcile that. And so there are different strategies on how to handle divergence. The easiest to work with for the compiler is what Mali does, where it gives you the same exact interface you would have on a CPU. You have conditional branches, you just write the code like you would write x86 assembly or ARM assembly, and there is a dedicated piece of hardware which handles reconvergence, that is, determines when threads need to be enabled and disabled. And aside from some basic hinting about the control flow graph that the compiler has to give, it's very simple to compile for. So that's one end of the spectrum. The complete other end of the spectrum would be what AMD does, which, to my understanding, is have the compiler manage everything itself. You have the execution masks for which threads are executing at once, and it's up to the compiler to manage that itself and do all of the analysis that Mali would be doing in hardware. That, from what I understand, is rather annoying for the ACO compiler to deal with, but again, it's clear where that would come from. Apple, on the other hand, has a, to the best of our knowledge, completely novel approach for this. Their entire handling of divergence is based around this idea that your control flow graph is nested. So when there's no divergence, there's zero nesting. If you're inside an if statement, there's one layer of nesting. If you have a for loop inside of an if statement, that's 2 layers of nesting, and so forth. And the whole technique is just counting the layers of nesting and working from there. Yeah, I don't know either what to make of that, but let's see how that plays out in practice. AGX has 32 threads in a warp, which is a fairly standard number for a desktop GPU. It has a execution mask, which is implicitly there, but which, unlike other GPUs, is not accessible in assembly. It has to be managed implicitly, and we'll see how you do that in a moment. It does have an explicit count of nesting in the control flow graph, and this is just a 16-bit register, a general purpose register that when you are doing control flow gets reserved for this nesting count. And then it has 2 classes of control flow instructions, we'll say. The first are jumps that are completely warp static. They apply to the entire set of 32 threads at once, which means you can't have divergence from them. And the other are structured control flow instructions. And it seems funny to talk about an if statement instruction or a while loop instruction, but that's very much how it's expressed in the AGX assembly. And these are internally, they're essentially arithmetic operations that are responsible for manipulating this nesting counter and manipulating the execution mask implicit register, which means when used correctly, it does correspond to the control flow that you're trying to do internally, but it's not always obvious how to take these primitives and map it back to, say, NIR's control flow, which is our job as a compiler. So for a recap, what do we have in NIR? Something much more simpler. There are if-else statements, there are infinite loops, and there are breaks and continues out of the infinite loops. That's it. So how do we map these? The easiest mapping we can do would be for an if statement. And because we have this if statement instruction, sort of, and the semantic here is that the hardware, when it gets this if statement instruction, will evaluate the condition, and then based on the condition, if the condition fails, it will increase the nesting count by one, and then update the execution mask. So if you think what that means, if a thread is active going into this, and then the condition fails, it will have a nesting count of one now, and then it will be inactive, and then it won't execute the body of the loop. However, if there are zero levels of nesting to become active again at the top, and the condition is true, then this if statement instruction does nothing because it's still active after, and it executes the body of the loop. And then at the end, we have to end the if statement by popping off this one layer of nesting. So then the threads that are active do nothing because it saturates at zero. There's no negative levels of nesting. But the threads that are skipped the if statement currently have their thread nesting level at one. So it pops down by one, and now they're active again because it's down to zero. However, the point of counting nesting is that if this if statement were embedded in a larger if statement or for loop or something, there could be other threads that were already inactive going into this if statement. So by adding to the nesting count, they will not only continue to skip this if statement, they will have their levels of nesting restored at the end by the pop. And this is sort of the point of having this nesting count as opposed to manually managing the execution mask. So if you look at this assembly, it's sort of clear where this comes about, but it's also very clearly strange. But I digress. How do we extend this to if-else statements? It's just as simple. We now have an else instruction in the middle that operates just as the logical complement, in a sense, of the if statement. So it will then swap all of the threads that have thread count or nesting count one to nesting count zero, making them active, and make all of the threads with count zero, so currently active, make them one, so they're inactive, then pop at the end. Great. This makes sense. It works. It passes the tests. What about loops? This is where things get kind of tricky and kind of complicated, and it will take us a number of steps to figure out how to get this right. So our first try would just be using this jump instruction. We have this warp static jump, so we can just use that to loop through the same number of instructions over and over. And we are using, in particular, this jump if any are active jump. But so fine, it's a loop. Not the kind of loop that NIR wants, because this is a loop for the 32 threads at once, not for just any one thread like NIR semantic. And there's no way to break out of it either. So our next thing to try is using the actual while instruction, which, again, remember, the control flow arithmetic instructions are not actually doing any control flow. They're just manipulating the execution mask and the nesting count, which means this while instruction alone would have no way to jump back. So we need both the while instruction and also the jump together, and you have them both together at the end of the loop. And so the trick that we have here is that, the way that this while loop instruction is working then is, in this case, it's just always, well, we'll see why we need it in a moment. The moral of the story is that we can still break out. We can now break out of this by manipulating the nesting count ourselves because it's just a register. So as a very simple example, if we are active, we have a nesting count of 0. But if we want to become inactive, we can set the nesting count to 1 and then force the execution mask to be re-updated by a sort of no operation control flow instruction. And this has the semantic then of making the thread go inactive. The other threads will continue to execute the loop, but eventually you'll get to the end. And if there are no more threads running the loop because they've all become inactive with this while and this pop and this break, then the jump execute any will not do any jump because there's no threads active anymore. And then we're done, except for the fact that all of your threads are inactive now, but details. Why don't we fix that? It would not be good to only be able to do a loop, and then once you're done with the loop, the whole execution is terminated. Likewise, if we have nested control flow, we don't want to clobber that either, which would be what would happen with our previous implementation. So in this case, we just need to push the nesting count up by 1 at the beginning and pop it down by 0 by 1 at the end. And things allegedly work out if you do it this way, allegedly. So this is a good start. It will implement an infinite loop faithfully, which is what NIR needs. We can break out of the inner loop. We can even break out of multiple loops at once, but NIR does not call for this. But what we can't do, and what there's no obvious way to do, is be able to do a continue in a loop. So at this point, you might be very stuck. When I was looking at the notes for this, I was stuck myself, didn't get it myself. And I was just hoping that magically a little birdie would come and whisper in my ear. And indeed, such a little birdie came named Dougal. And I will, in my ear said, quoth the Dougal, continue is a break. We can model a NIR loop as a pair of loops instead, with the inner one, a pair of do while loops, where the inner loop only runs for one iteration. So how do we handle this? Well, if we are trying to break out of the logical loop, that's breaking out of the outer loop. So we break out of two levels of nesting. If we're trying to just continue on the outer loop, then that's equivalent to just breaking out of the inner loop. And so we can implement both break and continue as break with two layers of nesting if we have two layers of nesting on the loop. And the best part about this is that the loop structure, so to speak, is implicit in the values of the nesting count. So this does not require any more instructions than would require otherwise. So we can use the same exact code we had before, but now instead of using one layer of nesting on each of the control flow instructions, we use two layers of nesting. And this gives us a completely natural way to implement both break and continue, just as different breaks. For a logical break, we break out of two loops. That's the break out of the outer loop. For the logical continue, we just break out of the inner loop. And the code is symmetric in this case, setting the nesting count and then resetting the execution mask to compensate. There's only one little wrinkle we're missing here, and that is what happens if you try to nest this loop inside some other piece of control flow. For example, if you had the loop inside of an if statement, then when you do it this way, after you finish the loops, then everything would be enabled again after, even if that thread wasn't executing the loop to begin with because it was on the other branch of the if statement. And the solution here is very simple. It's just to reset to the appropriate level of nesting. Namely, we need to add the numbers of levels of nesting outside of the loop to figure it out. And the other trick we can use here is that NIR only has two types of control flow. One are loops and the other are if statements. And the break only applies to the innermost loop, which means the only control flow that we're interested in counting is the number of nested if statements. And that is trivial to do with a little bookkeeping in the compiler and have working breaks and continues. And that finally will pass all of our control flow tests, and we'll be very happy because, you know, now we have control flow on our compiler. Woohoo! Not efficient control flow, but conformant control flow. So wrapping it up, the current status for this is that we have the DCP driver functional in a downstream fork of the kernel. I'm hoping to send off the initial RFC of these patches in the next few months, but there is a lot of cleanup to do. The code is functional, but not pretty to look at. As for AGX, the code is upstream in Mesa, passing about 95% of the DQP GLES-2 tests. However, that comes with the massive caveat that it's passing those tests under macOS, not under Linux, because we still have to write a kernel driver for AGX to be our glue between the Mesa user space and the AGX hardware on Linux. And we're again hoping to have that in the next few months. So thank you, and happy to answer questions. And just before we go, I would like to point out, if I can figure out how to share my screen. Stop sharing screen, start, select, entire screen. I have been doing this talk from my M1 device. See, Apple Mac Mini M1 2020. So it works. I mean, works, but it works. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your talk. Now for the Q&A. Ryan Hudek asks, does pushing and popping execution masks go to memory or some hardware stack?
Right. So there's not an explicit stack to the hardware. There is a imaginary stack that the compiler gets to keep track of. The only hardware state you have is the execution mask, so 32 bits per warp, and the nesting counter, which is really a count of levels of nesting until the thread becomes active again. And this is a 16-bit general purpose register that gets tied up for control flow and one per thread.
Okay, Person 1337 asks, what are the biggest features missing from Metal relative to OpenGL? Doesn't Apple implement OpenGL ES for WebGL?
Right, so if I were to design hardware, there are a lot of features in OpenGL which I would say are stupid and which I wouldn't want to include because they're useless, slow, etc. And eventually I would cave and implement them anyways because real applications use them. And even if well-written applications don't need them, translation layers, for example, Wine would still want them. And Apple has the luxury of being able to look at the same exact sets of features and just saying, you know what, we don't need those. We're getting rid of them in hardware. So all of the, basically anything that's deprecated in OpenGL, you're not going to find hardware support for in the M1. Anything, huge amounts of the geometry pipeline are done in shaders, which is fast enough in practice. I suspect transform feedback will have to be done in software, not because I've actually tested that theory, but because why on earth would they put transform feedback hardware on a part made for Metal, and so on and so forth. So it's the net result is that well-written applications on Linux will run just as fast as their Metal counterparts, but there will be a lot of hoops to jump through if we ever want to become conformant and support all the random ancient legacy things and want to pass all the piglets.
Okay, NeoBrain asks, any idea how the AGX design compares to PowerVR? Have you found any similarities so far based on what little Imagination publishes?
I haven't studied what Imagination has published, and PowerVR is, of course, the last remaining GPU to not have a Mesa driver, as far as I'm aware, so I can't comment there. The high-level design is similar in that they're both Tylers. They are both Okay, I guess that's where the similarities end. Apple clearly designed the AGX GPU for the iPhone with the purpose of having similar performance characteristics to the existing PowerVR parts, and it was not an atomic switch. It's my understanding that there were PowerVR parts with Apple instruction sets at one point shipping on iPhones and so on, and all of that was pretty much invisible to iOS developers because the performance characteristics didn't really change. The high-level design was essentially unmodified, even though all the details got swapped out.
Okay, Radek Schwichtenberg asks, are there big differences between M1 for Mac Pro versus Mac Mini or Air? How much do you think it will be needed to support newer versions?
It's the same system on chip. You know, M1 is M1. There are differences in binning. The MacBook Air M1 has one less GPU core than the other M1 devices, if that's software visible at all, it will be a short amount of code in the kernel, I imagine, not something user space worries about. Then there are the hardware, the different Macs are different themselves. For example, the Mac Mini has Ethernet and USB Type-A ports, and we have drivers for that in Linux. The MacBooks don't, but the MacBooks do have a camera and will need a camera driver that the Mac Mini doesn't. So I personally have a Mac Mini. I don't have any plans to get a MacBook, so that's where my development is biased. But we're hoping that Asahi Linux will support everything eventually.
And one last question. Patrick Jacobsen asks, is the DCP firmware redistributable, or do you need something like a download script like we have for FaceTime HD webcam drivers?
So this is a very interesting question. I wish I touched on this earlier. It's not redistributable, but that doesn't actually matter for our case because Linux never touches this firmware. It's on a internal system partition. So it's on the internal storage, but not on the operating system partition. It's loaded by the bootloader. Presumably it's signature checked by the bootloader, and then the firmware is locked. So the operating system, be it macOS or Linux, just does not touch this firmware. This is unfortunate to us because it means we can't modify the firmware to be less ridiculous, replace it with an open source version, even if we wanted to. However, it neatly avoids all of the legal questions because there's, from Linux's perspective, there's no firmware being used at all. And this is one of the great ironies of Asahi Linux to me, is that with the exception of the Wi-Fi, everything will work on Linux Libre. And this is very, very much not a Libre chip.
Okay, looks like that's it for today. Thank you very much for your great talk, Alyssa.
And thank you for having me.
Have a great conference.
I will now magically poof out of existence.